KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump campaigned on getting the U.S. out of foreign policy commitments and ending wars. What has brought the United States so close to joining Israel's war against Iran? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, an Iranian says even people who protested their government have to support their country now. May Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We also ask what power the United States gained when it claimed a golden share of U.S. steel. Also, how does a domestic violence advocate view the abuse case against Sean Combs? It's Wednesday, June 18th. This day in 1812, President James Madison signed a declaration of war against Great Britain. By 1814, the war was going so badly that the British came to Washington and burned the White House. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NPR has learned that Israeli officials believe the U.S. will join its military attack on Iran. Israel and Iran have fired missiles and drones at each other for 6 days. President Trump has said Iran's supreme leader would be a, quote, easy target. But some lawmakers are opposed. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine has introduced a resolution. He says under the Constitution, only Congress has the power to declare war.
I told myself when I came to the Senate that if I ever had the chance to stop this nation from getting into an unnecessary war, I would do everything I could to stop us from getting into an unnecessary war. I happen to believe that the United States engaging in a war against Iran, a third war in the Middle East since 2001, would be a catastrophic blunder for this country.
Senate Majority Leader Republican John Thune has dismissed the immediate need for a war powers resolution. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has updated its estimate on the cost of the tax and spending bill that's now in the Senate. NPR's Elena Moore reports the CBO says that over a decade, it would add about $2.8 trillion to the deficit.
That's a higher number than what the CBO originally projected the bill would cost. The new estimate factors in expected economic growth from the bill, but it also includes costs from increased interest rates. The CBO's projection deals with the House bill passed narrowly last month, and the Senate may make changes that could increase the estimate again. But the estimate also undermines GOP promises that their tax cut plan would grow the economy. Republicans have tried to discredit the nonpartisan CBO, but the latest figures could create further issues for some Republican fiscal hawks who have criticized the bills. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
A growing number of high-paying jobs no longer require a college degree. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports they're known as new-collar roles, and they focus on skills over diplomas.
Think cybersecurity analysts, cloud support specialists, project managers, and wind turbine technicians. Many of these jobs offer salaries of $80 to more than $100,000 a year, plus flexible hours and options to work remotely. These companies are using skills-first models, looking for hands-on experience, certifications, and problem-solving ability over academic credentials. Tech companies, manufacturers, and clean energy firms are leading the way, offering short-term training programs instead of four-year degrees. Experts say the trend is opening new doors for job seekers, especially those priced out of college or looking for a faster path to financial stability. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are up by more than 30 points. This is NPR. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is said to be alert and recovering after suffering an allergic reaction yesterday. NPR's Giles Snyder reports Noem was hospitalized.
The Homeland Security Department says Secretary Noem was taken to a hospital in Washington, D.C. out of an abundance of caution. Noem is one of President Trump's more visible cabinet members. As Homeland Security Secretary, she has taken on an active role in the administration's immigration crackdown.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. As summer heats up, people around the country are looking for places to cool down. For those in Manhattan, a new analysis shows one good place could be an elevated park called the High Line. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports.
The High Line was once an elevated railway. Now it's a park high above New York City streets, filled with native plants and even trees. All that vegetation cools the park down a lot compared to the nearby streets. Jen Brady is a data analyst at Climate Central.
In some areas, it's over 8 degrees cooler because it's dense trees in the middle of a dense neighborhood.
The skinny High Line stretches about a mile and a half up Manhattan's west side. Brady says its unique shape lets it act as a refuge for people along its whole length. And she says knowing how effectively it cools the area should encourage other cities to build similar green spaces. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
The National Hurricane Center says that Hurricane Eric is off Mexico's southern Pacific coast. It now has winds of about 75 miles per hour. Eric could make landfall tomorrow as a major hurricane. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
Jaime Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, a New York mayoral candidate was arrested by federal officials for escorting a migrant out of immigration court. But first, President Trump once distanced himself from Israel's military action. Now he's taken some ownership.
The president is talking in terms of we when he discusses Israel's war against Iran. He's even saying the United States could take out, his words, the supreme leader of Iran, calling Ayatollah Ali Khamenei an easy target who is only safe for now. The president has faced some pushback from his own political allies who oppose American involvement.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been covering this. So, Franco, President Trump spent the afternoon yesterday with his national security team in the Situation Room. What are the chances of deeper United States involvement here?
Yeah, that's the big question, and that was being debated in the Situation Room, you know, the future of U.S. action in this conflict. I mean, Trump has repeatedly said all options are on the table. He's drawn a red line if soldiers are targeted, but he's also signaling the U.S. is already more involved than the White House previously let on. Just as Steve was pointing out, he's boasting that, quote, we now have total complete control of the skies over Iran. He's saying we know where the supreme leader is. I mean, he's repeatedly using that word, we, blurring the line between Israel's objective and U.S. objectives. You know, and taking that kind of ownership has really raised more concerns of the U.S. getting more involved into another foreign conflict.
Yeah, so that's interesting because some of the people who are most concerned about foreign involvement are allies of President Trump. So tell us more about this friction.
Yeah, for someone who has such dedicated supporters, it's really notable that some of Trump's longtime backers are questioning his judgment here. Trump, of course, has long been known for his America First message. And some key conservative allies, such as former Fox News host Tucker Carlson and Trump's former White House aide Steve Bannon, see Trump straying from America First and are pressing him to stay out of this fight. Here's Carlson explaining his position on Bannon's podcast, War Room.
My interest is really simple. I don't want the United States enmeshed in another Middle Eastern war that doesn't serve our interests.
Now, Trump campaigned on ending long wars, peace through strength, he would say. I also spoke with Brett Bruen, who served as the White House Director of Global Engagement in the Obama administration. He said Trump supporters thought they were getting a president who was going to disentangle the U.S. from overseas commitments.
What they're seeing, however, is a president who is getting pulled back in to a foreign crisis that another country started and that the U.S. interest remains somewhat questionable.
Okay, so how is President Trump responding to these criticisms?
Well, he's pushing back, especially against Carlson. Trump posted on social media, quote, "Somebody please explain to kooky Tucker Carlson that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon."
No, you know, you mentioned enrichment. I remember like a few weeks ago, Trump had actually been talking about a deal right before with the most recent strike. So does this latest stance mean that diplomacy is now completely over?
Yeah, I mean, right now, Trump doesn't appear to be interested in diplomacy. He told reporters he's not in the mood to negotiate. What we don't know is whether at the same time this tough talk is part of his strategy to further pressure Iran, because he's also said he may send Vance and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to negotiate, though perhaps not right now.
All right, that's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Now we have a view from inside Iran. Sadereh Sadiki is an assistant professor at the University of Tehran's Faculty of World Studies. And as you would expect, the perspective you're about to hear is radically different than what you would hear outside her country. We reached Sadiki earlier today in Isfahan, a city that has a nuclear facility that has been hit in recent days by Israeli airstrikes. What have your last few days been like?
Well, it's been following the news and calling families and friends and checking on them to make sure they're safe. It's been stressful, but we're holding up and we're checking on each other and we're giving each other hopes and strengthening each other to go through this and to come out of it victorious, as Iran has always done.
We are, of course, talking with anybody we can find across Iran at this moment, and I was exchanging messages yesterday with a man who lives in Tehran, the capital, who fled to another city, as a lot of people are in Tehran.
Just a few minutes ago, I was talking to a colleague who has a two-year-old, and I was telling her, don't you think it's safer to just move outside Tehran and go somewhere? And she was telling me that this is her home and she wants to stay here. And so it's mixed feelings. And a lot of people have chosen to stay in their houses. You see even the younger generation posting videos of themselves from Tehran. The people that were probably part of the protest back 3 years ago, they're posting pictures of themselves and saying that they are from Tehran, they want to stay there, and they want to protect their country.
I want to clarify what you just said there when you talked about the protests 3 years ago. At that time, a lot of people were protesting against the rules for dress for women, protesting against the death of a young woman in police custody. And you're saying that you believe some of those people are on the side of the government in this situation. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, it's not the side of the government only. It's the side of Iran, because Israel is not attacking the Islamic Republic. Israel is attacking Iran and plus 90 million nation. And they understand that. When you kill civilians while they're sleeping in their houses and apartments, while they're walking down the streets, then people will start to realize that you do not care about them.
I guess we should mention Israel has accused Iran of having a secret nuclear weapons program. That's their justification for this attack. Iran has always denied that it is seeking a nuclear weapon. Setting aside the competing claims, what do you think of the idea of your country having a nuclear weapon?
Well, Israel has been saying for about 20 years at least that Iran is 1 month away from possessing a nuclear weapon. While I totally disagree with nuclear weapons, I think if Israel, Pakistan, India, the U.S., France, and other countries have the right to have nuclear weapons, then any other country should also have it. And Iran doesn't have one. So if there is any threat of nuclear weapons or the using of nuclear weapons, it's definitely the Israeli regime.
When Israel accuses Iran of being a short period of time away from a nuclear weapon, which they have said for many years, What is typically being discussed there is the breakout time, the idea being that if Iran went for a nuclear weapon, if they started to go for a nuclear weapon, they would be able to do it in that period of time. When you talk about who is attacking whom, I suppose people will want to mention that since 1979, Iran has called for the elimination of Israel and has battled Israel through proxy groups in a variety of different ways. Do you see Iran as being entirely innocent here?
Of course, I see Iran as entirely being innocent here, because Iran has been threatened by Israel. So far, whatever Iran has done has been for deterrence. Iran has never started a war. And you're saying that Iran has called for the elimination of the state of Israel. Iran has never called for the elimination of a people, but an occupying regime that has stolen land from people and has been a colonial project of the Zionist entity has been called for responsibility for the genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and Lebanese by many people, including international community. So I think it's ludicrous to think that Iran, which has not done any of those things, is a threat and wants to eliminate another quote-unquote country.
The United States government seems to be weighing whether and how to be involved in this war. What message, if any, would you send to Americans who are following this conflict?
I think it's important to remind American citizens that there is normal life going on in Tehran, and these policies affect ordinary people. And when war starts, it does not distinguish between pro-government and anti-government citizens. It kills everyone, and that's what Israel has been doing. So I think highlighting a normal life in Iran is very important. That's what Israel is trying to take away from Iranians.
Satare Sadiki is an assistant professor at the University of Tehran and is currently in the city of Isfahan, Iran. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A perspective from the other side, one of many voices we're hearing. Now, since that conversation was recorded, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has given a statement read by a television presenter saying that Iran will not accept President Trump's demand for a surrender, and he warned of irreparable damage if the U.S. attacks. We'll bring you more as we learn it.
A New York City politician was arrested by federal agents and detained for several hours yesterday as he tried to escort a man out of a routine immigration hearing who immigration agents wanted to arrest. Reporter Gwen Hogan with the local news website The City has more.
Brad Lander is New York City's controller, or fiscal watchdog, who is also running for mayor. The Democratic primary is fast approaching next week. And yesterday, when Lander went to escort immigrants safely out of court, he himself was taken into custody. Lander had locked arms with a Venezuelan man who was trying to leave an immigration courtroom. The two were surrounded by masked federal agents who'd been waiting in the hallway.
Do you have a judicial warrant?
Lander asked repeatedly to see the agent's arrest warrant, refusing to let go of the man's arm.
I will let go when you show me the judicial warrant.
Where is it?
Eventually, federal agents overpowered the two men and detained them both. In a statement, Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin said, quote, Lander was arrested for assaulting law enforcement and impeding a federal officer, unquote. But hours later, Lander was released without charges. He told a crowd of supporters gathered outside he was able to return to his family that night. But the man ICE detained was not so lucky.
He has been stripped of his due process rights.
That's right!
A country that is supposed to be founded on equal justice under law.
Lander is the latest elected official to face arrest during confrontations over President Trump's aggressive immigration policies. But Lander said he was undeterred and promised to accompany more people at immigration court soon. For NPR News, I'm Gwen Hogan in New York.
This is NPR News.
of a next fresh air. Dan Taberski, creator of the podcasts Missing Richard Simmons, 9/12, and Hysterical, which recently won an Ambie Podcast of the Year award, talks about why he's drawn to stories at the intersection of obsession, mystery, and culture. Hysterical investigates an outbreak of mysterious symptoms among teenage girls. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Total Wine & More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at totalwine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The United States is supporting a Japanese company's plan to buy U.S. steel in exchange for a share of power. It's called a golden share, making the U.S. a shareholder in the company, only a little more so. Nippon Steel had to make that concession, which will allow the Trump administration to enforce other promises that Nippon made, like investing $14 billion in U.S. steel. Industrial policy expert Todd Tucker says there are precedents for this arrangement.
A golden share is a mechanism that governments around the world have used to ensure national ownership and control over strategically important industries. So, you know, there's companies like Volkswagen in Germany, entities like the Heathrow Airport in the UK, where the government retains a golden share, which means that they have a say-so over any attempt to sell the company or sort of fundamentally reorganize what the company is trying to do.
Okay, so first you've told me that this is not a name that was developed by the Trump administration, where a lot of things are named after gold, the gold card and the gold decorations in the White House and so forth. This is like a normal term that people have used elsewhere in the world.
This is a normal term, and in fact, sort of the contemporary usage goes back to the United Kingdom, where during the Thatcher period, she instituted a policy of privatizing a lot of the publicly held companies. And sort of the compromise that she worked out was leaving the government with a golden share.
The way you're describing it, it sounds like veto power as opposed to power to affirmatively tell a company to do something.
It's a little more than that. The company will need to be consulting the government on a range of strategically important decisions, whether that's closing a plant, whether that's sort of changing the nature of the investment that they're going to be undertaking. So, you know, this will be a lot like other board seats.
I'm particularly interested in the $14 billion because I believe that investment is supposed to be over a number of years. And of course, you always wonder if the investment in the out years will materialize.
Yeah. And so this was the big sticking point during the Biden administration years, which is that this is a company, U.S. Steel and Nippon, that had a bit of a trust deficit with the public, with their workforce. They had made promises in the past that they hadn't lived up to. You know, steel is too important of an industry. We only have a handful of virgin steel facilities left in the U.S., and U.S. Steel controls about half of them. And the Biden administration just didn't think there would be a way to trust that the commitment that the company made today would stay true, you know, in the years ahead. And so this is actually an ingenious solution to that problem, which is to sort of say, okay, if we don't trust that you're going to do the right thing, we're going to sit on the board and make sure that you do the right thing.
Suppose Nippon doesn't do something that they have agreed to do. What would the United States be able to do to punish them using this golden share?
Well, I think, you know, what the U.S. is showing that it can do with the golden share is basically engage in a partial nationalization of the company. If the company just says, you know what, the private markets aren't smiling on our $14 billion investment, the U.S. government can say, okay, well, then we're going to run this more fully as a public company than even we did with this sort of intermediate step of the golden share.
So there's that implied threat of even more control.
That's right.
Does somebody at Nippon Steel, or for that matter, somebody at U.S. Steel, have to worry now about governmental mission creep? This president or a future president says, you know, I have this influence over your company. I sure think it'd be a great idea if you put all your assets into cryptocurrency. My meme coin, just hypothetically.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is a risk. Any company that seeks the approval of the government for this kind of action does run the risk that the government wants to get more involved. So, you know, Nippon opened up this possibility by seeking the merger in the first place. So now, absolutely, you know, there's maybe a good version of this, which is that you could imagine a future administration pushing the steel industry into doing green steel. That would be, from my point of view, a great thing. However, on the other hand, it also means that there's going to be folks that Trump appoints that can be, you know, dictating various aspects of the company's investment portfolio and other business decisions. And so, yeah, that could also run the risk of some corruption.
Todd Tucker, thanks so much for your time.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
He's Director of Industrial Policy and Trade at the Roosevelt Institute.
Conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones is being sued again. Families whose children were killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting won more than $1 billion in judgments against Jones for defamation. The new suit from a federal bankruptcy official accuses Jones of illegally trying to squirrel away his money to avoid paying up. Here's NPR's Tovia Smith.
Textbook fraud is how the U.S. bankruptcy trustee described it. He accuses Jones of a, quote, flurry of last-minute sales and transfers to his father, his ex-wife, and his kids' trust. Those included cars, condos, cash, and a ranch, all totaling some $5 million. In three lawsuits, bankruptcy trustee Christopher Murray says Jones was trying to keep it all from the Sandy Hook families who have yet to be paid for the massive judgments they won after Jones spread lies that their kids were never actually killed and his followers tormented them for years. Murray says Jones went to, quote, extraordinary lengths using sham transactions to try to hide his assets. One of the family's attorneys, Chris Maddie, says they've long suspected what he calls Jones's shenanigans, and they're now one step closer to getting any hidden assets back.
Very good news that there's now a legal mechanism to claw back money that he has transferred. So now it's just a question of collecting every penny he has, and it's obviously going to be far short of the $1.4 billion, but it's going to be what he has.
Attorneys for Jones and his father did not respond to requests for comment. Jones's ex-wife called the lawsuits harassment, according to the AP. Jones has long insisted he could not afford to pay the families even a fraction of what they're owed, as he did in this video he posted in 2023.
We are literally on empty. The money doesn't exist. So I don't like to laugh at these people, but I mean, I don't know how you don't.
Jones is now entitled to a trial on whether the money did exist and whether he intentionally made it go away. Experts say it looks like the trustee has got the receipts.
These types of transactions are as old as time itself. Jones shouldn't be surprised when he's on the losing end of these lawsuits later on.
Bruce Markell is a former federal bankruptcy judge and now professor at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law.
Jones is clearly in the crosshairs of the trustee, and the trustee has a fairly accurate rifle.
It could be more than a year before any trial on whether Jones intended to defraud the families. For now, their attorneys say the families will continue to pursue the assets Jones still has. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
PEPFAR, the U.S. global HIV-AIDS program, supported millions of AIDS orphans and vulnerable children. Now, many of them have no support after massive cuts to foreign aid.
She has no chance unless someone can get her medicine in the middle of rural Zambia. Who's going to do that?
I'm Juana Summers, the story of one child and a pastor's quest to help her on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. An Israeli official speaking on condition of anonymity tells NPR Israel believes the U.S. will join its military offensive against Iran now in its sixth day. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports on what President Trump has been saying about the possibility of U.S. involvement.
Trump has repeatedly said all options are on the table. He's drawn a red line if soldiers are targeted, but he's also signaling the U.S. is already more involved than the White House previously let on. He's boasting that, quote, we now have total complete control of the skies over Iran. He's saying we know where the supreme leader is. He's repeatedly using that word we, blurring the line between Israel's objective and U.S. objectives.
Yesterday, the president called for Iran's unconditional surrender. The Department of Homeland Security says federal immigration officers will continue carrying out raids in industries that employ lots of people who are in the U.S. without legal status. Those include agriculture, construction, and hospitality. Juan Ibarra sells produce in downtown Los Angeles. He says a lot of Hispanic restaurateurs, street vendors, and food truck operators are shut down right now.
It's a ghost town pretty much right now. No traffic, nothing. No food. You know, all the good food places are closed right now, so it's kind of rough.
This is NPR News. Forecasters say Hurricane Eric could strengthen into a major storm as it approaches southern Mexico sometime tomorrow. That means at least Category 3, with winds of more than 110 miles per hour. Eric is forecast to cause mudslides and widespread flooding from up to 20 inches of rain. Hundreds of items from the estate of the late filmmaker David Lynch are being auctioned off today. His movies included Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, and The Elephant Man. As NPR's Emma Bowman reports, Lynch died in January at the age of 78.
Online bidding for the Lynch auction is open, and Catherine Williamson, the head of Hollywood memorabilia at Julian's Auction House, says it's drawing massive interest.
There are three of us old-timers at Julian's, and none of us have ever seen a sale catch fire like this one.
She thinks this auction is resonating strongly with Lynch fans because the items on auction include a lot of what you might expect to find in his home. Memorabilia from his films, unfinished scripts, an array of camera equipment. His extensive espresso and coffee machine collection, for example, prove that his love for coffee, a recurring theme in his art, was real. Emma Bowman, NPR News.
Despite pressure from President Trump, the Federal Reserve is expected to leave U.S. interest rates alone when it wraps up its latest policy meeting today. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. People far beyond the music world have been riveted by the trial of hip-hop superstar Sean Combs, also known as Diddy, who's been charged with serious crimes, including sex trafficking, stemming mainly from his years-long relationship with former protege Cassie Ventura. Ventura has testified that she was forced to participate in degrading sexual encounters and faced beatings and other abuse when she tried to resist. Combs has pleaded not guilty, with his lawyers and some public supporters arguing that while the relationship may have been unorthodox, toxic, and even violent, it was all consensual, and Combs did not commit any crimes. We wanted to talk about that last part with Leslie Morgan Steiner. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Crazy Love, about her experience as a survivor of domestic violence. She has almost 5 million views of her TED Talk on that subject, and she's with us now. Leslie Morgan Steiner, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
I wanted to know what struck you as you learned about this case.
The first thing that struck me as a domestic violence survivor and advocate is that Sean Combs is an extreme example of a male perpetrator of violence against women. And we don't understand violence against women very well in our culture. What Cassie Ventura and other women went through is much more what I went through, which is that we fell in love with a dangerous man. And in Cassie's case, Sean Combs was a billionaire, and she is a young singer just starting out, and he has power over her financially. In addition to that, he fed her drugs, allegedly. You know, the relationship lasted over 10 years, but within a really short period of time, it was clear that given his willingness to use all of the tools at his disposal, he was able to dominate and control her life.
You don't kind of fit the profile of what people think a victim of domestic violence is, because, you know, you are a person who's very accomplished in your own right. And similarly, I think there are some people who don't understand why somebody as pretty as a Cassie Ventura, as talented as a Cassie Ventura, would get mired in a relationship that was as abusive as she testifies that it was. So could you talk about that?
I think this is the most difficult thing for people who've never been in an abusive relationship to understand, is how anybody who could arguably just walk away at any moment stays, and stays again in Cassie Ventura's case for years. And I stayed for years too. And I had a degree from Harvard. I was earning an MBA from Wharton. I had the support of my family, which Cassie also had. And it's a real cocktail of power and control and trauma bonding. And these men, including Sean Combs, despite the heinous acts that he allegedly has committed and people have testified to, was also alternatively very charming and very supportive of Cassie Ventura. And when you mix love, violence, trauma, and support, it becomes incredibly confusing for the victim. And this is why I stayed. You know, my ex-husband held loaded guns to my head. He strangled me. He beat me over many years. And sometimes, you know, the morning after a beating, he would smile and tell me I was beautiful and that I was going to be a great writer one day, and picking out names for our children. I was the woman of his dreams. And it does something to you, very powerful psychologically.
One of the ways the relationship between Combs and Ventura became public, or that the nature of it became public, was a security camera footage from a hotel where Cassie Ventura was clearly trying to leave, and that Sean Combs came running out and hit her, kicked her, and dragged her back to this room. Okay. There was testimony during the trial that he paid a very large sum of money to try to keep this tape private. It ultimately became public. But one of the other things that became clear in this trial is that a lot of other people saw it. And so I wanted to ask you about that. Why is it that they didn't seem to help? They were scared for her, but nobody did anything about it. And I wondered if the same thing happened to you. Did people know what was going on with you? Did anybody try to help you?
In my case, most people didn't know I was being abused, and I didn't want people to know that because I knew that my ex-husband would get in trouble for doing it. I was very much his protector in a obtuse psychological way, and part of that is what seems to be going on with Cassie Ventura, is that, you know, here's the man who in so many ways was a hero in her life, and she didn't want to expose him. In addition to the regular dynamics of abuse, you have to layer on Sean Combs' immense wealth and power in an industry, the music industry, where they're very ambitious people who feel like they will ruin their own potential careers if they expose him. And the video that almost everybody has seen, it's a 2016 hotel video that was leaked by CNN in 2024. It's her literally trying to leave. It answers that question, why don't abuse victims leave? She tried to leave and he dragged her back. That video was proof of what Cassie Ventura was alleging. And That kind of proof is what every abuse victim wants, and so few of us get. So she was finally believed.
There are those who will just object to your characterization of her as a victim. There are those who have said, and including some, you know, one or two public figures, but also there are members of the public who've sort of communicated this, that they don't think she's a victim. They think she's a willing participant in a very unhealthy relationship. So people who think that, what would you say?
I would say that they're partially right. That the tricky thing with understanding abuse is that the victims themselves seem as if they are willing participants. And Cassie Ventura was getting a lot of really powerful positives from Sean Combs. Love, attention, support of her career, celebrity. And I think the question that everybody has to ask is, does that mean that he had the right to abuse her? And I would say no.
And for those who might think that Cassie Ventura's story has nothing to do with them, what might you say?
I would say that every time we hear about somebody being abused, instead of just dismissing them, to stop and think about your own relationship history, your wife, your daughter, your son, your mother, the people who you work with, everybody who you know, because I promise you, abuse is so widespread that you know somebody who is an abuse victim right now, and to just have more compassion. The most important thing that any victim of abuse needs is to be believed. It's a simple thing, but it's actually pretty hard to do, is to say, I believe the victim in this case. I believe Cassie Ventura. And if you're still having trouble, please go watch that 2024 CNN video of her being beaten, and to just know that what happened to her behind closed doors was 1,000 times worse than what we actually saw on that video.
That's author Leslie Morgan Steiner. She's the author of Crazy Love, as well as other books. Leslie Morgan Steiner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
Israel and Iran launch strikes at each other. We're taking a look at the U.S. role in the region, including the Reagan-era Iran-Contra scandal. That's next up on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with news you can relish. Joey Chestnut and the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest are squashing their beef. The competitive eater skipped last year's fight over a contract dispute. He had signed a deal with Impossible Foods. After some contract tweaks, Chestnut is once again aiming for the Wiener's Circle. Winner's Circle. Last year's champ ate 58 hot dogs. Frankly, the champ may now have to catch up. Chestnut's record is 76. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services. dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Inflation is much lower than it was a few years ago, but that just means prices aren't increasing as fast, not that they're going down. Prices at the grocery store are still higher than they were before the pandemic, and along the U.S. southern border, some families find savings by grocery shopping in Mexico. Angela Corcherga reports.
In a brightly lit grocery store in Juarez, music sets a festive mood. Savvy shopper Diana Garcia is in the produce section looking for the best prices. The Juarez mother says she sees a lot of people from the U.S. buying groceries here. And more are doing so, Garcia says, because of the strong dollar to peso exchange rate. Stretching that dollar is a necessity for families coping with higher food prices on the U.S. side of the border. Cristina Castruita and her husband routinely shop in Juarez, which borders El Paso.
We've been doing it since the kids were babies, especially because the formula is half the cost in Mexico than it is in El Paso, and it's a better name brand too.
Castruita says now she shops for cheaper brand name laundry detergent for her boys aged 8 and 10. Her oldest son, Alfredo, chimes in with his own price-saving favorites.
A lot of fruits, they're bigger, less expensive, they taste better. The watermelons tend to be nicer.
Watermelons are allowed, but some produce is prohibited by the U.S. because it could carry agricultural pests. His mother says when it comes to fruit and other items, she likes the variety available in Mexico.
We buy a lot of things like yogurt because we have, not only is it cheaper, but we have really exotic and different flavors available.
The dairy section in most Mexican grocery stores is much larger. Other items the family buys?
We prefer Mexican ketchup also, and of course tortillas. We buy them in bulk and then freeze them.
Generations on the border have looked to Mexico for lower prices and a wider selection, and vice versa. Shoppers from Mexico also cross into the U.S. for certain items, including clothes and electronics. Tom Fullerton is a professor of economics at the University of Texas at El Paso.
That's sort of the holy trinity of retail economics, when consumers can have access to lower prices, better quality, and more variety.
A survey by the city of El Paso just months before the pandemic found local residents spend about $352 million a year on groceries in Mexico. Fullerton tracks the border economic outlook in this region in an annual report. He expects higher U.S. tariffs to affect shopping behavior all along the border.
From Brownsville all the way to San Diego, they'll cross the border and take advantage of lower prices as a consequence of what in effect would amount to a federal sales tax.
Beyond chasing cheaper prices, it's a way of life on the border. The kids get a haircut, the family enjoys a meal, and time with other relatives, all in Mexico. Castruita says there are many reasons to spend an afternoon across the border.
To save myself some money, to expose the kids to their culture, and just for fun. It's cheaper and delicious.
For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Climate change intensifies storms, and that adds to destruction, which can sometimes create an opportunity to rebuild better and stronger. But NPR and our partners at the PBS series Frontline found that recovery often gets bogged down. NPR's Laura Sullivan reports on how that keeps Americans vulnerable.
Nothing about surviving a hurricane was ever going to be easy. But in western North Carolina, in the months after Helene, we found people struggling to get on the same page. Kit Kramer, the head of the local Chamber of Commerce, walked along the empty streets of Biltmore Village, a once bustling tourist area in Asheville.
Right now, we need the jobs, we need visitors, we need customers.
She says the priority is to reopen, even if it means rebuilding the same as before in a place that floods repeatedly.
It can come back better, and I want that to happen over time. But right now, we need the jobs.
But Asheville Mayor Esther Mannheimer has been trying to convince people to elevate properties and build them stronger.
We could lessen the overall disruption to a community, the hit on the economy, on the lives of the people, and we would rebound from it quicker. But I think individual property owners would say, well, why do I have to bear the burden of that?
That is what some people are saying. People like North Carolina Congressman Chuck Edwards.
What's difficult is the premise that our government would tell a property owner what they can and they can't do on their own property. There are reasonable regulations that we should consider out there, but number one, I think we need to consider the rights of the people that own the property.
Disaster recovery has always been fraught. Telling people who just survived a catastrophe to rebuild to higher standards often doesn't go over well, and that conflict grinds communities down. That's what New York found after Superstorm Sandy hit in 2012.
We put a lot of stuff right back where it was.
Craig Fugate was the head of FEMA during the recovery as the state struggled to implement a series of government programs that sent homeowners, even on the same block, in different directions. Some worked to elevate their homes, some took buyouts and leveled their homes, and some did nothing. I asked Fugate, what's the plan here?
There is no plan. People like to think there's a plan, but understand the complexity of, one, I got to deal with property rights and property owners. I also have to understand most of this is economically driven. Developers will come in there and start putting cash on the streets to buy out distressed property.
These competing forces leave many communities stuck halfway through a recovery as disasters become forgotten with time. On Staten Island, after the government spent more than $200 million buying out homeowners' properties, some people now want to see those empty lots redeveloped, like Staten Island Borough President Vito Fisella.
You have some of the best views around and underappreciated of the water. We should welcome people to build near the water when possible and bring life back as opposed to watching empty lots.
Nobody just steps back and says, let's think about how we can really fix this right.
Brad Gehr helped lead disaster recovery for New York City and FEMA and now works as a consultant for Tidal Basin.
That big vision. It runs out of steam. The train runs out of steam because you just get worn down.
When Hurricane Harvey left the third of Houston underwater in 2017, the city turned its focus to engineering its way out of the problem, spending millions to shore up its dams, build storage basins, and widen drainage canals. But many of them haven't panned out the way people hoped either.
So you can see where it's flat here. They widen this all the way out 30 miles.
On a recent afternoon, Phil Bedian, a civil engineer who studies flood models at Rice University, stood next to one of the city's enormous man-made concrete canals. It was recently upgraded, mostly since Harvey, at a cost of $480 million.
So how much did it lower the water?
According to my calculations, it lowered it in the range of a foot or so.
But Harvey flooded this neighborhood with 4 to 6 feet of water.
Yes, it did.
Is this what we're doing now? Well, saving a foot?
I think they just had no choice but to move forward. They had the money. It had been approved. Remember, these are Army Corps of Engineer projects that take decades to come to fruition.
Do we have decades?
I'm not sure we do.
As hurricane season begins this month, the question now is which community will face these tough decisions next. Laura Sullivan, NPR News.
For more, listen to NPR's Up First podcast, Unprepared, and watch Frontline's documentary, Hurricane Helene's Deadly Warning, streaming now.
Canadian writer Dan Rubenstein traveled from Ottawa to New York City by paddling.
I kind of liken it to walking on water, Jesus illusion notwithstanding.
All right, not a miracle necessarily. He stood on an inflatable paddleboard.
And he says it has better views than a kayak.
You can look down into the water, so you can see fish, you can see plants, you can see yourself more integrated into this aquatic environment.
Okay, Canada to New York City, 1,200 miles round trip, down the Ottawa River to Montreal. Then, if I understand the maps, you portage, you go over land for a little bit, and then you're in the river system going down the Hudson River all the way to New York, where he met a friend.
Where we went out and around the Statue of Liberty, so much boat traffic, so many tour boats, police boats, tugboats, tankers, etc.
All right, how's this for multitasking? On the way, he wrote about how water helps people, the benefits of being in blue space.
The aquatic equivalent of green space, whether it's a vast ocean or a river or an urban pond or even a fountain.
Rubenstein says when he'd wake up anxious about his work or about turning 50 or about climate change, he would paddle.
Within an hour of setting out in the morning, I would stop worrying. Sometimes I would just stop thinking, looking at and listening to the plants and animals. I'd be talking to whatever animals I saw. So I really felt at home in that environment.
And Rubenstein says the 11-week voyage helped him to explore communities.
Blue space does have this capacity to connect people. It makes us feel good. It slows us down. And because of the dangers of water, we tend to watch out for one another when we're around water. So because of those three things, I think it has this capacity to help people see one another as fellow human beings. And that's something that's, one could say, in short supply these days.
Dan Rubenstein wrote a book about it all. It's called Waterborne, a 1,200-mile paddleboarding pilgrimage. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I've been to the nation, and I've been to the territory. I've been to the nation, I've been to the territory. And I'm a hard luck guy, get the devil everywhere I go.